Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
It's the UConn Popcast. I'm Professor Stephen Dyson.
And I'm Professor Jeff Dudas.
Jeff, Taylor Swift is dumb and her music sucks.
That's wrong.
So wrote Sean Davies, CEO and co-founder of conservative web magazine The Federalist on X in September. And I think this shows that Taylor has exploded into the political realm in recent months. And I think we should talk about it.
We should definitely talk about it.
And you are just the man to talk about it, Jeff, because I think by any scientific measure, you have become the world's foremost Taylor Swift academic expert.
Yeah, I'm the go-to.
You're the go-to guy for Newsweek, which has interviewed you several times on this subject, and NPR.
Yep.
So, terrific. I'm very honored. Thank you for being here.
Well, but you know, this is the interview I've been waiting for, though.
Yes, this is the one you really wanted.
Yeah.
The one you finally landed. So, I think we're going to proceed in several parts, but first of all, I thought we might just briefly sort of recap or try and get the measure of what are some of the political things that have been happening in Taylor world. And this is an artist who, when she began her career, was avowedly sort of apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
And she would say things like, you know, we are drilled in country music not to, you know, shove your politics down people's throats and just let them live their lives.
Yes.
And has become, in some ways through her own actions and in other ways through, you know, the reactions of others, really a central political figure. Some people are even saying could be a decisive political figure in the 2024 presidential election.
Right.
What's happened?
So I think the essential context and backdrop here is the sort of explosion of Taylor Swift as inarguably the world's most popular person. And that has really happened in conjunction with the exercise of her Eras tour, which has, you know, broke all kinds of records, sold out everywhere it's been.
Literally seismic.
It is literally seismic.
Right, like it's recorded on, isn't it counted as minor earthquakes?
Her rendition of Cruel Summer in Seattle shook the ground, literally shook the ground at a level that would register, that did register on seismic counters. So her fans refer to that as a Swift quake.
Okay.
And so that is the essential context here. She went from being an extremely popular person to being, I would argue, unprecedentedly popular. And with that, her persona has so suffused world popular culture, but American popular culture in particular, that it feels like one of those moments where people who don't actually even know anything about her or anything about the music feel compelled to offer their takes. And you know that when you reach that level of saturation, that you have become someone who needs to be paid attention to. And I think what we'll find as we talk today is that at that point, what becomes really important about you maybe doesn't really have anything to do with you as a flesh and blood and person anymore, but rather with the reactions that are prompted by your persona.
Yes. Although it is true that Taylor Swift is now more explicitly inserting herself into the political process than was true at the start of her career. I mean, the start of this was probably the quite famous segment in Miss Americana where she talks about her support of, her opposition to Marsha Blackburn and support of Phil
Bresden.
Yeah, as a senatorial candidate, and that was an explicitly sort of partisan political statement. She endorsed President Biden in 2020.
Yes.
And then more recently, she just sort of encourages her supporters to either vote or register for vote, but never quite says for whom one should vote.
Exactly. You're exactly right. She is certainly much more engaged in that way politically than she ever was before. But it remains a fairly anodyne, and especially these voter registration drives. One would think, at least from the outside, that these are relatively anodyne and inoffensive, nonpartisan types of interventions in politics. The fact that they have not been received in those ways, I think, is very revealing. And is something that we should definitely.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I want to. What do I want to say here? The statement on its face, go and register for vote to vote is, you know, by definition a non-partisan statement. And there's a great precedent of celebrity figures making statements like this. I mean, I think of like MTV's Rock the Vote campaign, and that was. Commonly taken to be a non-partisan act, right? Because surely it's just supporting the political process. And Taylor Swift has said recently things like, I want you to go out and vote for the people who represent you. Mm-hmm. I would suggest, Professor, and push back on this if you like, that it's a little disingenuous to say that there is no partisan lean or valence to those statements, given the likelihood of people who are likely to be Taylor Swift's demographic, who are going to follow her on Instagram, which you'd suspect would skew young, and the political proclivities of that demographic. And so a common political goal of the Democratic Party is to increase turnout amongst like 18 to 30-year-olds.
Yes.
And they don't do that because it's like just a nice democratic thing to have that group participating, although it is, and although you can make statements and veil them behind saying this is a nice part of the democratic process, they do that because it's a target demographic that is likely to support their electoral interests. And so, yes, she's not out there saying, I hate Trump, vote Biden, at least not yet. But it's also a little disingenuous to suggest that one political party does not benefit from the things that she's saying. Would you not agree?
No, that's clearly true. Okay. And there is a little bit of a having your cake and eating it too element to this. It is, however, quite different than some other celebrity engagements with electoral politics. And that is notable. I think the kind of the hyperventilating response on the part of the American right to her sort of forays into the electoral arena are very revealing.
Okay, so let's put that on the table. There were a series of things that seem to bring this to the boil. There's of course her statements about voter registration, which I think started in like September of last year, and she's recently repeated them, or similar statements saying vote on Super Tuesday for whoever represents you. There is her romance with Travis Kelce.
So I think this is actually really important as well. I think it's probably the second piece of the essential context, right? The one is the fabulous success of the Eras Tour. The second is Taylor's engagement with the NFL. The NFL is, by some measure, the most popular sport in the United States.
It's not cricket?
It's not cricket.
Huh.
Sadly. I know that's, you know. As a good Brit, that's got to be hard to accept.
Yeah, exactly. Like but, NFL Super Sunday is more popular than the Willow cricket app.
Surprisingly.
Which you can watch England versus India at midnight.
And what do they call that? That's the, what's the name of that?
The cricket app?
Yeah.
It's called Willow.
No, but what's the competition between England and India called?
No, you're thinking of the Ashes, which
the
is between
Ashes.
England and Australia.
Okay,
that's
Ashes.
Not England-India.
No, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it turns out Super Bowl Sunday is more important for a demographic in the United States.
Fascinating.
It's hard to believe. That was really the one sort of arena in American life that it's not clear that Taylor Swift's aesthetic had introduced itself to.
The NFL.
The NFL.
I would say what's it like, stock car racing as well?
But even then, it's a little overrated. As I say that, I want to walk it back well. What the NFL, you know, surveys and viewership demographic information reveals is that its audience is about half women.
Okay.
Right. But the NFL remains very much a male-coded environment in a lot of ways. And so when you get this kind of mixture of the success of the Eras Tour with all of a sudden Taylor showing up in the luxury boxes of NFL stadiums every Sunday, particularly during playoff Sundays, it seems those two things seem to generate a real kind of visceral response amongst some observers.
Yeah.
And I think those are the things, those are the kind of the essential props that help us to make sense of what's happening with reactions to and treatments of Taylor Swift as a popular culture icon rather than a flesh and blood person necessarily.
Right. And the NFL's now, I mean, you said male coded, would you agree also slightly conservative coded?
Yes.
In the same way, and this is why Taylor Swift's fascinating, because this reminds me of her origins in country music, which, you know, you could also say is at least slightly conservative.
Yes, the NFL does not have the reputation of being an especially progressive sports league, as opposed to something like the NBA.
Well, and also the a lot of the pageantry that surrounds NFL games, there's often...
There's a lot of militarization.
I was going to say, exactly, which, I mean, there's nothing, of course, wrong with the military, but just taken as a cultural text,
it
tends to be slightly conservative coded.
Right. And remember when so the one of the important figures here in this conversation with the NFL is the former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who was for all intents and purposes blacklisted from playing in the NFL as a result of his protesting of the playing of the national anthem before every game.
Right.
And that is not something that you would have seen in a lot of the different leagues around the world. I mean, think about the difference between, you know, sport that and a league that you are is near and dear to your heart, the English Premier League, right?
Yeah, which
for well more than a year,
right?
Each game was begun, each match was begun, right? Was taking
the knee. And still occasionally is,
right?
Yeah.
So it's you're dealing with an activity that is coded. Not simply has been male coded in spite of the actual demographics of the viewership, but is also a sport that has been pretty conservative and pretty hesitant or even paranoiac, really, around matters of sort of progressive social and political issues.
Yeah. So there's sort of a paragraph here from a New York Times story on Taylor that maybe brings a lot of these things together. The Swift-Kelsey storyline for some has delivered a bruising hit to traditional gender norms, with a rich, powerful woman elevating a successful football player to a new level of fame. Then Swift bashing reached Fox News in mid-January. The host, Jesse Waters, suggested the superstar was a Defense Department asset engaging in psychological warfare. He tied Miss Swift's political voice with her boyfriend's Pfizer endorsement to the remarkable success...
And Bud Light. Right,
okay.
which has been also the target, Bud Light, several months back, the target of boycotts on the right because of their contractual relationship with a transgender figure.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The remarkable success of her Eras Tour, which bolstered local economies and landed her on the cover of Time. Have you ever wondered why or how she blew up like this? Mr. Waters wondered on air. Well, around 4 years ago, the Pentagon Psychological Operations Unit floated turning Taylor Swift into an asset during a NATO meeting. Can you confirm?
I cannot.
So there was a NATO meeting in the Pentagon, which is an interesting idea. I obviously can't comment on that. I don't have the sort of insight into internal Pentagon operations.
You can't prove it didn't happen.
Mr. Waters, well, and nor can you.
And that's
what they don't want you to know.
Right.
And so that's I think the background to our conversation today. We have a sort of three-part method we often apply, and I think here we will move into a discussion perhaps less of the immediate political context surrounding Taylor Swift, and maybe more into something we more commonly do on this podcast, which is a sort of a reading of Taylor Swift as a popular cultural text, which of course has huge political overtones.
Yes.
We tend to discuss these texts in three parts. We talk about meanings on the surface, which tend to be tied to authorial intentions. How is it that that the person or the book or the movie or the piece of music or whatever it is we're discussing seems to present itself or themselves. We then talk about the mythological or cultural meaning structures that seem to add or change that kind of interpretation. And often we talk about that in terms of things the audience brings to the table, less the author. And then thirdly, we talk about a sort of critical level, which sometimes literally means what critics and then sort of elites seem to be making of this text. Other times means taking a sort of against the grain reading of the text or looking for something that is subverting the normal way of doing things that exists within the text.
Yeah, so our method is, but for us at this point, it's familiar. But what's not familiar here is our subject matter. Mm-hmm. We have not yet treated a flesh and blood person as though they were a text or read a flesh and blood person and the persona that they cultivate and that is projected onto them as a text that has political meanings.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Should be read.
Now we did, I mean, I was going to correct you there. We did talk about Olivia Rodrigo, but now I think about it, we talked almost explicitly about her music rather than her persona.
Correct.
Perhaps because she doesn't have, and I don't want to start a huge war here. I know there's also rumors of...
Careful of the Livies.
Yeah, exactly. There's rumors of, you know, what their relationship is like. But perhaps because she doesn't quite have the cultural presence, although she's highly successful, that Taylor Swift did. She's not quite at that level of...
And I don't think it's controversial to say she just doesn't have the length of the career.
Right, yes.
At this point, right? Okay. Taylor's been doing this since 2007 or 2008.
Right.
And has been at a very high level of saturation, media saturation from the beginning.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into it. Mm-hmm. And we'll be right back. And we are back with our discussion of Taylor Swift as a popular cultural phenomena. We want to operate first and on the level of on the surface in this section, which really focuses on sort of authorial intention, how Taylor Swift presents herself. I think you have some thoughts on this, Jeff.
Yeah, so what we know about Taylor is that she is very canny and very focused and very intentional about matters of self-presentation. And we can see this in a whole variety of different ways. Think about, for example, the re-recordings of her older albums, which is, we won't spend a lot of time here because that has been a matter that has been covered a lot. But the very act of reclaiming note for note, literally, those original recordings, and not simply doing it as an act of artistic freedom that allows her to get essentially to get back control of the masters of her recordings, but the way in which she has released those re-recordings on a very consistent schedule, every couple months they come out, the ways in which she has integrated the releases of those, the re-releases of those re-recordings with new music, right, as well. So you're getting something. At this point, she's in this kind of what certainly feels like a years-long plan to have something like new music being released every 3 or 4 months, almost on a quarterly basis. And when you think about that, if your goal was to reach mass levels of saturation, to be as popular as possible, which Taylor has been pretty honest that is, has always been a big goal of hers, this is a kind of a genius way to do it, because there's never a media cycle throughout the year that you won't be hitting in one way or another. As soon as it seems like you're sort of starting to fade out, you come back with some new product. And obviously, in order to pull that off, it takes an immense amount of coordination and an immense amount of work. And so we're always hearing these stories of, you know, Taylor in the middle of the night in recording studios, you know, here and there. And this is what she's doing. She's recording new music. She's writing new music. She's re-recording stuff. So there's an articulated plan in which she's very much dedicated to the consistent presentation of herself as a vital creative force that's not going to go away, right?
Right, and one that's sort of constant and not intermittent. Mm-hmm. And it is a really interesting strategy, because one of the things that's happening in music is that new music is becoming sort of less important or less popular. And what seems to be happening in the age of streaming, in the age of Spotify, is that it is artists' catalogs or older music that dominates those services, and so he's dominating the consciousness, and all music is given a new life by like finding a new audience,
yeah,
because it's sort of all decontextualized on these mm-hmm. on these streaming services. It's not something that can only be found on a CD and that's, you know, your dad might have or mom might have on a shelf,
right,
and you might discover it that way. It's, well, you know, it's the Friends theme tune, and that's mm-hmm. just as available as the new record by, you know, some new artist. So it's really changing, I think, how artists, you know, maintain a presence, which used to depend upon brand new creative product,
right?
But there would be a big bang, and that would only happen kind of once a year or once every other year. But what Taylor is,
if the artist was especially prolific,
exactly,
yeah,
exactly. But what Taylor is doing is managing to maintain a sort of ubiquity mm-hmm. or a consistency of new content.
Yes,
because of course a lot of the content is not new; it's
right.
re-releases of old stuff.
And it's not just the volume of new things that are being released. There's also within each release, she's releasing 6, 7, 8 different, slightly different versions. Right, so there might be 4 different versions of an album on vinyl, and the only thing that differentiates them, sometimes one might have a bonus track on it. But frequently, the only thing that differentiates these releases from one another, these products from one another, is like a different cover.
Yeah.
Right? Or like maybe even a different font.
Yeah.
Right? And so each product that's getting released is getting released in a whole bunch of different formats, with the idea of being not that you choose the one that you like the best, but rather that you buy all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this kind of mastermind quality, and with the title of one of Taylor's songs from her last original album, Midnights, right? There's this kind of mastermind element of the way in which she is clearly directing a career and directing the insertion of self, or at least the insertion of a sense or an image of self consistently into the marketplace. So the other thing that is happening, and that's, I think, a kind of an adjunct strategy to this, is her command of the social media space. Now, what's interesting here is that she does not actually post a lot of stuff on, for example, her Instagram account. Typically, she will post either when it comes time to announce a new release, or when she's on tour. She will frequently have, the way that the Eras Tour works is that they're usually a Friday, Saturday, Sunday night show in each location. And she will have some kind of post commemorating that run in, you know, wherever, Sydney or Boston or wherever it is.
Thank you, Sydney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We, you know, some pictures and maybe a little bit of audio.
Okay.
Right. But there are certainly celebrities and popular musicians even who are significantly more active on social media as an author than she is. But what she does do is she has consistently played this kind of game with her most loyal fans, in which she'll do things like offer little clues or little hints about what's coming forward, what they call Easter eggs, of course. And it's there's a lot of orchestration of this kind of online social media community of Swifties. For example, the most latest, when she announced a new, it was at the night of the Grammys when she announced a new album that's coming out in a couple of months, maybe next month. She sort of, you know, misled the audience with some of these Easter eggs into thinking that she was going to be announcing that night not a new album, but rather a new edition of one of the Taylor's versions of her album Reputation. And then, of course, she shocks them all with a different announcement instead. And there is this kind of orchestration, right, that's very intentional and conscious that she engages in with her most loyal fans that really does nothing more but further bond them to one another. And so there's a kind of a mastery, and she's capable of using the social media strategy and the communities, the online fan communities that are built and maintained through those mediums in very effective ways. All of this, again, is to cultivate a kind of persona of somebody who's super productive, but also kind of mysterious, but also playful, and generous, right, in a way that is very endearing to her fan community. These are all things that she's intentionally doing, right? And these are the images, I think, that she's trying to cultivate as imagining herself as a brand. And so that is unusual, right? I mean, other artists, you know, typically have some interaction with fans, but not to this level and this degree of kind of winking playfulness that she has consistently attempted to do.
Yeah, and that idea of her as a brand or as something more than quote unquote just a just an artist, I think, is really sort of central. There's a quote I'd like to read you from a different New York Times piece that says, "In the world of Taylor Swift, the start of a new era means the release of new art, an album and the paratexts, music videos, promotional ephemera, narratives that supplement it, and a wholesale remaking of the aesthetics that will accompany its promotion, release, and memorializing. Yes. In recent years, Ms. Swift has dominated pop culture to such a degree that these transformations often end up altering American culture in the process."
Mm.
And so it's not just, you know, as you say, that there's new product, new music coming. It's that there's a whole machine of supplementary texts,
yes,
paratexts, as the quote says, that extend this and that sort of really shift the cultural weather.
Yeah, and just as one really prominent example of this is her use of colors and the association of particular colors with these different eras in her career. And this is another way that she's sort of coding maybe what's coming next or signaling to a loyal audience of what's coming. So, for example, when the Fearless album was being re-released, all of a sudden there was a lot of, you know, she was wearing a lot of purple. And the light sequences at the shows were very heavy on purple. One of the reasons why people are so convinced that the next album re-release, Taylor's version re-release, is going to be the album Reputation is because that has associated the color black with the kind of the aesthetics of that era and that album. And she's taken to being photographed and being out in public wearing a lot of black outfits,
right?
And a lot of kind of jewelry and the kind of the aesthetic that was associated with Reputation tour. So 1989 was the color was blue. The album Red, unsurprisingly, the color red.
I see what she did there.
So they're all, you know, and this is, of course, there's a long history in art of associating emotions with particular colors.
Sure.
Right. And so that's part of what's going on, but it's the creation of this elaborate sense of a reality, right? A paratext, as the author notes, in which even such a commonplace object as color gets intractably associated with Taylor Swift.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, there's two points I wanted to make here. One was, as I understand the Eras tour, you know, she sort of inhabits all of these personas in one night.
Yes.
Which is sort of a remarkable demonstration of a chameleon-like quality. It's one thing to go through a phase in your life where you wear black, but these are phases in one evening in which she's becoming essentially a different version of herself. And also it means that the Eras tour is it 42 songs?
45 songs.
45 songs, which is an astonishing
somewhere between 3.5 and 4 hours.
Just an amazing
It's an amazing feat. And it's without precedent for that style of pop music.
Yeah.
So the only other analog in popular music that I am familiar with that kind of length of shows would have been the Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band shows from the 1970s and 1980s, which routinely stretched to 4 hours.
Yeah.
And those were highly physical events as well, but not in the way, right? There's no costume changes, right, that are taking place in the Springsteen concerts. There are no elaborate set designs that are being moved in back and forth. And there was no, part of this is that the technology didn't exist, but there isn't the creation of that kind of arena-like environment that is, again, color-coded and, you know, with all kinds of you know, really interesting and meaningful aesthetic choices that are being made as well.
Yeah.
So there really isn't an analog for this as well. And to do it is, you know, and there's a ton of dancing and there's a ton of singing and there's a ton of costume changes and the whole thing. It's a quite astonishing act of physicality, one for which Taylor's famously trained for like 6 months. And there's some TikToks out there of people trying to do the Taylor Swift workout and failing miserably because it's so intense.
Yeah, I mean, the other point I wanted to make about this was that another word for all that stuff that goes along with a Taylor era is a scene, right? Mm-hmm. Like the you know, they're commonly music scenes, mm-hmm. and these would have cultural impact, and they would include all of these things, like mm-hmm. the you know, the a specific way of dressing, a specific way, a specific haircut, mm-hmm. a specific way of, a specific set of things you were allowed to like, yeah. and weren't quite allowed to like. But the way a scene usually operates is there's definitely like a leader, you know, usually like a prominent, you think of Britpop and like yeah. Oasis, yeah. And, but even then there was Blur as well, you know, yeah. so they were kind of co-leaders. But they couldn't unilaterally determine what the scene was or change it on a dime.
Right.
And in actual, and all the other bands that would be in the scene were actually being prescribed like uniforms you essentially had to wear,
yeah.
and ways to look. And they certainly couldn't influence. So the scene dominated the artist,
mm-hmm.
whereas with Taylor, right. it seems that the artist herself is inventing and reinventing mm-hmm. the scene sort of unilaterally and at will.
At will, unilaterally and at will, and also in a seamless fashion so that she can move from one to the other with no apparent or obvious disjuncture or discomfort.
Yeah. Friction.
Yeah, or friction, yeah. yeah. And one couldn't imagine, for example, the Gallagher brothers suddenly becoming Southern rockers or grungers.
So no,
right?
so,
or vice versa, right? Kurt Cobain is not going to suddenly become, he's not going to become part of the Minneapolis scene when Prince is dominating.
I actually remember, I mean, as so often, Noel Gallagher has a great quote on this, yeah. which is, it was put to him that his songwriting was assuming a somewhat samey kind of quality. Mm-hmm. And he said, look, I write songs on a guitar. It's not going to sound like Jean-Michel Jarre. Which yeah. kind of neatly summed up that. But yes, right. you're right. He wasn't going to start doing something totally different.
Yeah. And the only act in popular music that I can sort of analogize.
You've got to say the Beatles.
Is the Beatles.
Yes.
And again, the difference there is that is compressed into this tiny, comparatively tiny time span
right.
and timeline, as opposed to Taylor, who's been doing it now for almost 20 years.
Yeah, and on her own. I mean, the Beatles yeah. were a composition of
right.
several, you know, generationally significant yes. artists who could then pull the whole collective mm-hmm. in one. The collective could change mm-hmm. by just spotlighting one of them more right. than the
and other. That stops, of course, when the band breaks up.
Yeah.
And there's some really strong individual solo material,
right.
but you don't get that kind of aesthetic hopping
yes.
anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
Wings, the band the Beatles could have been.
Thankfully, the band that they weren't.
The band that they weren't, yeah. though. Okay, would you like to pivot now to our
yes.
second section,
yes.
Where we talk about kind of cultural mythologies and maybe even shade over into kind of criticality?
Yeah.
Jeff, I'm going to read you a quote from Jeff Dudas.
Yeah.
That's gonna provide this kind of bridging thing. I mean, I know you're working on a kind of scholarly mm-hmm. piece of work about Taylor Swift, and you kindly shared it with me.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I thought a quote that might make this pivot for us. You know, comes from that piece. So this is you. It's kind of weird that I'm reading your words in my voice with you stood right there. I mean, I know it's something of a dream of yours, but anyway, let me get into it. How, to coin a phrase, are we to understand American popular culture, Taylor's version?
Mm.
How should we read the meanings of Taylor Swift, the popular cultural text, as opposed to Taylor Swift, the flesh and blood person? And how do these meanings point us not to Taylor Swift at all, but rather to our own selves and the politics in which those selves are enmeshed? When Taylor Swift, a self-confessed mirror ball, shows us every version of ourselves, what is it that we see? Join us in just a second to find out. And we are back with our discussion of Taylor Swift as a popular cultural and political figure. I think now, Jeff, we're going to move into our second section of analysis, which moves away maybe from authorial intentions and meanings that are presented on the surface, and moves towards an understanding of things like cultural meaning structures mm-hmm. and critical approaches and responses to the person as text. Mm-hmm. And actually that sort of phrase, the person as text,
mm-hmm.
I think is probably crucial to this
yeah.
section, because in our first section we were painting a picture of Taylor Swift as a person who has an almost unique ability to command their meanings within the popular culture and to determine how they're seen.
Yes.
But even someone as, you know, unbelievably popular and clearly skilled
yeah.
as at doing that as Taylor Swift is not always going to be in control of the meanings that they make.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a kind of subtitle for this section of our discussion could be what happens when a person loses control of their of their text.
Yeah.
You know, and where the text is the person themselves. It's not just their public persona, but their public persona is obviously intricately and inextricably interwoven with some of the deepest seated matters of identity.
Exactly. And this is something we know, right? We know that this is routinely what happens to creative products and creative texts, is that the author only has so much control over the way that the text is going to be received. And as you say, what's interesting and provocative to consider about Taylor Swift is that here, at least the way that we're thinking about it for our purposes today, is that she is the text.
Yeah.
Right? The text is a flesh and blood person. And so what happens when that person loses control of or doesn't have full control over the meanings that they have sought to brand themselves with?
Right. So what does happen? I mean, you're the one who's writing the definitive account of this phenomenon.
I mean, a lot of things happen, some of which are, I think, point towards things that are positive, right? Outcomes that are relatively positive and generous. Other elements point to sort of darker elements, which we should spend some time with. And I think we should begin by talking about the way that the fan culture around Taylor Swift has developed. And I especially want us to talk about a phenomenon that is more general than just Taylor, but absolutely encompasses her. And this is what we might call the culture of stanning, stanning.
So this comes from Eminem's hit song,
yes,
Stan.
Yep.
Which was a story of an obsessed fan of Eminem himself, who ends up committing a series of sort of horrifying acts, and it's like an epistolary song. The lyric, isn't it? Which is, it Stan writes a number of letters to Eminem, and then Eminem responds, unfortunately, a little belatedly, and says, "Crikey, tone it down, mate."
Yeah.
Although he's not British, he doesn't quite use that phraseology.
No.
But then the name of that song became associated with a much broader phenomenon of, what would you say, like an obsessive or misguided fan?
The way that it's used, and this is one of the things I think that's so interesting about the phenomenon, is that the way, by and large, that the term stanning is used is to portray one's the positive elements of being a big obsessive fan.
Okay.
And
also, so the phenomenon became divorced from its initial
meaning, right?
I haven't quite realized.
We get multiple layers of the loss of authorial intention here, right?
Yeah.
So it's not simply that Taylor is an example of somebody who loses authorial intention over her own self. It's that Eminem loses authorial intention over what he intends or means to get across in the terms with the song Stan. And this is especially strange, I think, to me, or especially illustrative of the limited control that an author has, because I asked you to listen again to Stan before we started, and you said it had been a while. There's nothing that's ambivalent or ambiguous about what's going on in Stan, right?
No, it's a very clear cut. It's actually quite a linear story.
Yes.
You know, and the only real twist is at the very end, Eminem realizes, like, oh shit, this is you who I saw on the news.
But it is absolutely a cautionary tale about what scholars refer to as the parasocial identification between a fan and a celebrity. And by parasocial, Britt, the idea here is that you have a scenario in which people imagine themselves to have close personal relationships with people that they don't know, who they don't know in person. So connected, so inspired, so engaged with the creative product that the person mistakes that familiarity and that sense of meaning and that sense of intimacy that they might have with the creative product with the person who has put it into the world in the first place. And so what Eminem is singing about, or what he's rapping about, is the ways in which this kind of parasocial identification can go so extreme, right, that it can lead to scenarios in which disturbed people, right, imagine these close personal relationships in such a way that they then hold the celebrity responsible for their own acts of dysfunction or violence or homicidal intent. And we have historical analogs to this, and we have historical analogs in the world of popular music, right? Mm-hmm. This is the story of John Lennon's assassination by Mark David Chapman.
Yeah.
Right? Chapman is a huge Beatles fan who somehow imagines a close personal relationship with John Lennon that somehow Lennon, in his post-Beatles years, has personally offended.
Yes.
And let Chapman down.
Yeah.
And that as a result, he must be assassinated. He must be killed. And these are admittedly extreme responses.
Right.
But
which was the one who was trying to impress Jodie Foster?
So this is the would-be assassin of Ronald Reagan.
That's it.
This is
yes.
John Hinckley.
Yes.
Right. Who, and there are real layers of dysfunctional depth with that case, because he gets fixated, Hinckley does, and he had stalked Jodie Foster. This wasn't just he had actually taken positive or active measures,
yeah,
right, to get her attention. And he first becomes obsessed with her by watching Taxi Driver, in which Jodie Foster plays this kind of teenage girl who's forced into prostitution and who begins this kind of weird relationship with the Travis Bickle character played by Robert De Niro. And Robert De Niro himself had engaged in parasocial identification with a woman who was a campaign worker played by Sybil Shepherd of a political candidate and had attempted to assassinate the political candidate in order to get the positive attention of Sybil Shepherd.
Yeah.
So there are these strange kinds of, you know, interpenetrations that are sometimes happening, and they're all kind of wrapped up or can get wrapped up in these kinds of parasocial identifications. And so this is what Eminem is referencing very clearly. It seems to me you don't have to be familiar with the Lennon and the Reagan would-be assassination in order to understand what Eminem is getting at, right? But I would call it a misappropriation, but you could call it a reappropriation of the term itself and draining it of its ambivalent and largely critical elements, and imagining calling yourself a stan of someone as though that were an unambiguously positive thing is a very interesting kind of phenomenon.
Right.
And that's absolutely part of what's going on with regard to the meanings that Taylor puts out there about herself, right? That there is this huge stanning phenomenon that's associated with her amongst Swifties, right? And for the most part, what we know about this is that it's a pretty positive thing. And there's a lot of studies in a lot of scholarship in an area of studies called fandom studies,
yeah,
which actually illustrate that most of these kinds of intense kind of fan communities are actually pretty positive things for the people who are involved in them.
Yeah.
That they tend to be pretty inclusive. They tend to be a way for otherwise diverse audiences and diverse peoples to make obvious contact with one another.
Right, and they become maybe less about the artist or the text, but actually more about the connections amongst the members of the community.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that there frequently are really positive elements of this. And that is definitely one of the things that you would see if you were to attend one of these Eras concert tours, is that by and large, people have reported almost exclusively, in fact, that the environment of being at the show is so positive and so inclusive and so generative and connective between the audience members that it actually has led a lot of people to have these kinds of literally out of body experiences, right? That's all positive stuff, right? And it's all stuff that may not make a big difference in the way that a community organizes itself over time in general, but it certainly doesn't hurt, right? There you would be hard pressed to find some kind of, you know, negative element of that. So the kinds of things that Eminem is talking about are admittedly extreme examples, but they do exist, and they do exist within this contemporary standing culture, yeah, as well. Typically these days, they reveal themselves as these kind of vitriolic attacks that one superfan will levy against the superfans of another group who's perceived as a rival, or sometimes against the actual artist themselves who's perceived as a rival. And this can lead to some really ugly stuff. And in the Taylor Swift world, the story that immediately comes to mind is when, Taylor famously had this very short fling with John Mayer, the singer-songwriter and guitar player John Mayer. And Mayer was much older, like 10 years older than Taylor. And Taylor wrote a song called Dear John, which, you know, unsurprisingly, it was about that. And so Mayer became one of these kind of, you know, cast of villains, right, within the Taylor Swift community of, you know, romantic community, I guess, or romantic engagements. And he had sort of faded from that, you know, from being one of the bete noirs of the Swiftie world until she re-released, I think it's Fearless, right, which has Dear John on it. And there were some, you know, cases of like certain fans like reaching out and being very abusive to Mayer, like through his social media accounts, like, you know, sliding into his DMs, so to speak, you know. And there was this famous example. He actually responded to one of them, and he said, "I don't understand. Why are you so angry at me? I don't understand what this is about." And the fan was shocked that he responded to her, and she said, "I didn't actually think that you read this. I didn't think you ran this account."
What she's really saying is, I didn't actually think of you as a real person, right? I thought you were just this kind of apparition that we'd conjured.
Yeah,
and it was John Mayer the villain, not John Mayer the real person.
Exactly. And Taylor, to her great credit, recognized what was happening and sort of put out an affirmative statement, said, "You know, leave him alone."
Yeah,
right. Like, the song is not. It's no longer about him,
yeah,
right? Leave him alone. Same thing happened to Jake Gyllenhaal,
yeah,
with the re-recording of the Taylor's version of Red with All Too Well, right? And All Too Well is one of Taylor's great, great songs. And it's widely considered to be about Jake Gyllenhaal. And, you know, he caught a lot of flack, right? And so these people, they come back in and they become... they go through the ringer again, right? And they go through the ringer not necessarily because Taylor's encouraging people to have them go through the ringer, but because some segment of her fan base perceives this as an act of loyalty.
Yeah.
Right? An act of what they call defending Taylor. Now, Taylor doesn't need to be defended. She doesn't need anybody defending her, right? She's a billionaire who's always the most powerful person in every room that she steps into. But it's the sort of dubious behavior that sometimes emerges out of these parasocial relationships. And again, they rarely rise to the level, thankfully, of the kinds of things that Eminem is warning against, but sometimes they do.
Yeah.
And there are these kind of, you know, undercurrents of dysfunction that can come along with this kind of super fandom.
So I wonder if this also helps us to make a little bit more sense of the sort of strength of conservative reaction to Taylor Swift.
Yes,
and because you've got elements of kind of dashed expectations or dashed hopes that sort of recur. You know, here is a cultural figure that comes out of country music, and later, as we said, the analog is, you know, gets very interested in the NFL.
Yep.
She's a woman that for a long period of time sort of maintained a political silence where most artists were saying things that were clearly liberal.
Right.
And all of these things, you know, white, blonde hair, blue-eyed woman, all of these things had seemed to allow space for the belief that, well, she's actually secretly a conservative kind of princess, and she's
and even more than that, Stephen, because her silence had been interpreted by extreme, like, you know, by white supremacists essentially, as suggesting that she was this kind of secret Nordic queen, right, who was actually in league with the white supremacists,
right? And so when she actually comes out and says things that sort of seem to definitively take those interpretations off the table. You know, they were highly speculative and in the sort of wildly unlikely interpretations to begin with. But within the culture of someone who's undergoing a stunning phenomenon, you know, that they start to become very convincing and actually very personal forms of reading and interpretation.
Yes.
And so the reaction when those things are publicly dashed is of a peculiarly personal insult.
Exactly. And it also points that points exactly to one of the concerns and one of the real deep worries that observers of modern and contemporary politics have about the you know, the withering of democratic practices across the world and the withering of a kind of democratic ethos and the rise and the seeming to be the increasing popularity of a kind of authoritarian strongman type of politics that on one hand feels out of place because it feels a lot more like the kinds of early 20th or mid-20th century politics that you would find in regions like Latin America, for example, or Eastern Europe. But on the other hand, these are, you know, it, what you get here is a real concern that you're developing a culture of hero worship in which you look to a particular set of people to kind of guide you as community leaders. And that comes at the expense of the sense that the community itself and that ordinary people themselves should empower us to govern ourselves, right? And so it's a short step. It strikes me as a short step from being concerned about the more extreme responses of the kind of loyal responses of the standing phenomenon to the kind of I am the state sorts of claims and personas that strongman authoritarians and would-be dictators have historically and contemporarily continued to make.
Yeah. Okay, fascinating. So, Jeff, you've done a lot of research on sort of, I think, specifically conservative fears and responses to perceived subversives kind of within the American society, within our midst. And I wonder if you'd like to talk about Taylor in this.
Yeah, this is amazing. Context. This is amazing. Because this is what you had talked about in our first segment, the Jesse Waters kind of, you know, wide-ranging and strange conspiracy theory about Taylor Swift as a kind of psyops operation that was being conducted by a variety of different organizations, both in and out of government. But that kind of imagination of a wide-ranging conspiracy that means to undermine the American nation itself and to subject American citizens to external control, that narrative is literally as old as the nation itself, and it recurs again and again. And it has certain plot points, right? It typically features some sort of unholy conspiracy between an external power and some group of both witting and unwitting internal collaborators, I guess, or corroborators, maybe?
Fifth columnists.
Yeah, within the nation, right? Who, they're all in league with one another, and the goal is to subject, you know, the virtuous American citizens to external control, something akin to, like, slavery. And it's all very shadowy, and there's a cabal of different forces, and they're all working in league with one another. And it's a frightening kind of existential or subversive attack on the nation. And as a very common plot line in the history of American politics, as I say, it recurs over and over. And there are almost always multiple iterations of this in each generation. So it's got a kind of a time out of mind quality about it. And so in some ways, it's not in the least bit surprising that when you get Taylor Swift ascending to this level of saturation and prominence, that it's not going to take long before she gets slotted in to whatever the newest version of this counter-subversive conspiracy fantasy is. And that's what we get here. And it was really prompted by, again, the conjunction of the Eras Tour success with her engagement with the NFL. And, you know, throw in Travis Kelce's work with the pharmaceutical companies and Bud Light, as were Budweiser as well. And so you get, I mean, these are always unhinged, right? These conspiracy theories are always unhinged. But this one is especially crazy, right? So you've got, as far as anyone can tell, you've got Bud Light and Pfizer who are interested in this conspiracy of promoting Taylor.
Yeah. I want to be clear, you've done research into this, and you're presenting this as fact, right? So so Bud White and Pfizer, I'm going to follow Bud White and Pfizer.
So as far as anyone can tell, they're interested.
I mean, I was in your office, and on the wall, there were all these kind of pieces of red kind of string pointing to
yeah.
the Bud logo, and then a Pfizer one, and there was a connection there. I just want to be sure we...
Well, it's hard to hide.
It's accurate.
It's hard to hide this stuff from you. I mean, you're pretty perceptive. So, but as far as anyone can tell, Pfizer and Bud Light, their interest is, you know, comes to the table through Travis Kelce, right? Okay. They've hired to pitch COVID-19 vaccines on one hand,
and
Bud Light on the other hand, right? But what they're really pitching, of course, is their nefarious agendas. Right. So Pfizer's nefarious agenda is to, I don't know, implant microchips, I think, in all of us through
Isn't
the vaccine.
Is it now Pfizer? Is that
I think it's
the
Pfizer
torch
now.
Passed, has it?
Yeah, okay. To do that and to continue to make lots of money off of it. Budweiser's nefarious agenda is to promote transsexuality.
Okay.
And to normalize it, which we know is a hot flashpoint in current culture wars.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got the NFL, who is desperate to have Taylor on their TV screens every week because, in fact, right, a relatively large new viewing demographic began tuning into these playoff games to watch the Kansas City Chiefs play, not because they care about the result on the field, but because every so often there'd be a cutaway to the luxury box and we'd see Taylor and her friends, like Blake Lively, for example.
I mean, look, the actual, not to interrupt this, but the actual conspiracy is in plain sight, which is all of these things are tremendous for making money.
Yes. and in fact, the NFL has estimated to have its media exposure have increased by like $330 million just as a result of Taylor Swift going to the games.
Yeah.
Right. So the NFL is absolutely interested, right, in putting her on screen.
I hope they give her free tickets.
The conspiracy is that they are rigging the games so that the Chiefs continue to win. And
move
on.
I see. Okay.
Because if the Chiefs don't win, right, then she's not going to get to the games anymore to support her.
I understand.
Her paramour.
Okay.
So then you've got the Defense Department is somehow involved, and that's... We know the Defense Department is involved, but we don't know why. I guess NATO is involved in some way,
mm-hmm.
but it's unclear what the end game of that is. The FBI could be involved. The FBI seems to be involved because this is anti-Trump stuff.
Okay.
Right?
Oh, and they're out to get
They're
Trump.
Out to get Trump.
I see, okay.
And so I guess the idea is that Taylor Swift is, by endorsing Joe Biden, somehow get Trump.
Okay.
Now, why the FBI is supposed to be concerned about elections is unclear.
Right.
Right. Because if the FBI is the shadowy, all-encompassing and all-knowing and all-powerful organization that the conspiracy theorists claim it to be, they wouldn't care about elections at all. Why would they waste their time with elections when they could just, you know, do their other nefarious underdeeds? But be that as it may. The Biden campaign, of course, wants Taylor's endorsement, and they want...
Well, that's true. That's not a conspiracy theory. I mean, they can't say it.
That is also true. They want to be able to put her... they want to be able to put her out to sing songs, you know, in front of them to do voter mobilization and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it all is meant to fit together, right, in a way. And again, the thing about these forms of conspiracy theorists, as you have been consistently kind of reminding us, is that there are elements of them that are sort of in isolation plausible, right? But when you fit them all together, and the dark design is that the goal is to destroy the nation, to undermine the nation, to take it over with thought control, to destroy American democracy, that's when things start to get difficult, right? Logically difficult conceptually. But the other thing that these counter-subversive conspiracy theories have always done is they have always acted in some ways as acts of projection. Essentially, what this Taylor Swift PSYOP conspiracy theory is suggesting is that the Biden administration and the Democratic Party in particular trying to steal elections, right, in underhanded ways. Well, we know exactly we know exactly who actually tried to steal a presidential election. So they're acts of projection, right? They're dark fears that also confess some latent desire on the part of the people who are most interested in the conspiracy. This is what they want to be able to do themselves.
Okay. Okay. That's fascinating. Yeah. I didn't quite put together all the elements of the
That's because you have, I don't see any in this office. I don't see any pins or, you know, string connecting the various things.
No, I got to get to work on something along those lines. Is there any other area you'd like to go in, Jeff? Or do you think we've covered Taylor the text?
I think we've given our audience.
Okay, so here's how I want to finish, Jeff.
Yeah,
you are Nate Silver. Congratulations.
No.
You're running your.
What does he do now? He doesn't run 5:30 anymore, does he?
Substack.
Okay.
You are and plays poker.
Okay.
It's a true story. Okay. Actually has a book coming out on like playing poker and taking risk and so on and so forth. But famous, you know, election prognosticator and puts kind of quantitative probabilities on the outcomes of particular elections. You're running your high level Nate Silver model, you know,
yep.
Beep, boop, 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 boop. And it comes out with that's the noise the model makes as it's yep. running, and it comes out today with a probability that Joe Biden is, let's say, 40% likely to be reelected.
Mm-hmm.
Taylor Swift endorses him.
Mm-hmm.
What change to those happens to those probabilities?
1% maybe?
Up?
41%. Yeah.
Okay.
It's certainly at the margins.
Okay.
Right. And this is because I think that the people who would be already inclined or the people who would be moved by Taylor's endorsement or by her exaltations to go out and register to vote will already be inclined to do that.
Okay.
Like, I don't think she's turning otherwise.
People are not getting
disinterested voters.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, you heard it here first. If Taylor endorses it, we'll make a 1% chance,
yep.
Difference, sorry, to the outcome of the presidential election. You can take that to the bank.
To the Substack.
Take that to the Substack.
Yeah.
And on that bombshell,